Call to order. We have a quorum.
Bill?
Representative Sundin, have you had a chance to approve the minutes in your own mind?
Yes, I have.
Would you move that?
Yeah.
You have moved it. Okay. All in favor of... Oh, is there any discussion on the minutes? If not, all in favor, what? March 7th. All in favor of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same side. Minutes are adopted for March 7th. We're going to go a little out of order in order to accommodate members who have other commitments at this time. So the first one we will take up is House File 1280 Hillstrom. Welcome to the committee, and I will move that that House File 1280 will be up for consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've been contacted by the United States Transportation Union regarding a controversial transportation policy question regarding the installation of driver feedback safety monitor cameras with audio capacity in railroad, train, crew vans, and yard utility vehicles. In 2010, a conference committee amendment permitted the use of these devices, and this was the first legislative review of these devices since that time. The United Transportation Union seeks to have these devices removed from railroad crew vans, which hold a separate chapter in statute. With me today to explain this bill is Mr. Phil Qualley. He's the state director for the United Transportation Union and the general vice general chairman, Jeremy Brown from the UTU, is also with me. And Matt LeBane, peer safety trainer from the UTU Union. With that, I'd like to turn that over to my testifiers, Mr. Chair, so that they can talk about the safety issues that have arisen with this this equipment.
Would you identify yourself for the tape, Mr. Qualley?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you. My name is Philip Qualley. I am state director for the United Transportation Union, a rail division of the Sheet Metals Air Rail and Transit Union, representing over 1,200 UTU members in Minnesota. And I have 32 years as a railroad conductor on the Union Pacific and Chicago Northwestern Railroads. If I may proceed.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to first state that for UTU members, railroad workers, this is a safety issue. This is not a collective bargaining issue. Our railroad workers across Minnesota have made it very clear to me that we respectfully wish to have these devices removed from our crew vans in Minnesota. These devices needlessly obstruct our view through the windshield and delay sight lines or obstruct sight lines and cause delay to reaction time to road and rail yard hazards. We do not believe these devices are consistent with the intentions of Minnesota Statutes 169-71 prohibition of windshields. If you'd be so kind, if you would please refer to your handout, you will see photos of these devices, as well as photo exhibit 2 of the equipment along a railroad yard. Again, we seek to, with House File 1280, we seek to have these monitoring devices removed from railroad crew vans, a category set forth in Statutes 2210255. We believe that this device is reactive and not preventative safety technology. We believe that there are other better preventative technologies available. And again, we all agree on the mission for safety here. But weighing an object that size in the windshield, we simply believe that there are better options available. We have had near misses with these devices out in the roads where we've had, and we'll have testifiers go into detail there. But I want to particularly draw a concern that when we're driving on yard roads with tracks in a rail yard on either side of us, we are on a radio frequency. However, we have railroad workers that are out working in between the equipment, hanging air and preparing trains. We have had members come through the sides of the cars and again into the road, and we have this 4-inch by 4-inch square box that does obstruct the view. Very quickly, I would also ask you to refer to your handout, and you'll see with items 3 that UTU has reason to believe the carriers are not actually reviewing the data or using these devices intended. You will see Union Pacific safety hotline information that shows a driver was reported as unsafe conditions in October of 2012, and then later was reported again November 10th, and yet the driver was not removed from service until November 20th, 40 days after the report of first unsafe driver. If they are using these devices to monitor safety of the drivers, this is certainly a concern in this present instance, and this is one of several that were reported to the office. Another piece that we're concerned about with this equipment is there is no information being collected on the effectiveness of these devices, summary of record of incidents, a trigger of unsafe accidents, and we also question the state of repair. I will turn it over to some testifiers here, but I will mention that if I don't get a chance to speak again before the committee on this issue, as I know time is tight, I know that our respective colleagues and esteemed opponents will be showing a video of this device. My hope is that their presentation will portray a true condition of many of our crew van drivers who are often well into their senior years. As am I, but they are driving long, irregular shifts and overnight. And we also would hope that these devices will be used to comply with statute 2210255 so that we could confirm their hours of service and that they are getting the adequate rest and show how long these drivers are actually behind the wheel. It is a number one safety concern for railroad workers in the state that other than grade crossing accidents and pedestrian collisions, when we're off of our trains and in a crew van traveling across the countryside at night or out in the dark, it's one of the toughest parts of our jobs for safety. So I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing my testimony, and I will turn it over to Jeremy Brown of Local 1000, BNSF's Vice General Chairman with Contractual
Authority.
Let me ask
you a question first, Mr. Crawley. Are these on the open road or just in your railroad yards that these are used?
Both, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And we seek to only prohibit them in railroad crew vans, a separate area of statute. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeremy, come on over.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Jeremy Brown. I'm a local chairman for the United Transportation Union, Local 1000. I represent the safety and contractual interests of over 240 UTU members on the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway from the Northtown Twin Cities Terminal through Staples into the Dilworth, Moorhead, Fargo, Duluth areas and across northern Minnesota. I'm also a vice general chairman on the UTU General Committee of Adjustment for Switchmen, representing nearly 750 switchmen from Seattle into the Twin Cities area. I have over 20 years of experience as a railroader. 16 of those years have been as a switchman for the BNSF. On behalf of our local, and also speaking for the railroad crew van drivers, these so-called safety devices are a detriment to the safety, and respectfully, we want them removed from our crew vans. These cameras obstruct the view out the front of the windshield of our crew vans and the on-property utility vehicles. Our utility workers driving vehicles in the railroad yard are expected to multitask, operating radios, checking car numbers, hanging air hoses in between the rail cars, inspecting the rail cars, and throughout the course of an eight-hour shift, we may get in and out of these vans in excess of 50 times to line switches and perform other tasks. We've had several close calls when driving on yard roads between tracks. Other workers who are walking their train, climbing on and through the rail cars and the standing trains, they swing out onto the road in front of us and they're placed into a blind spot behind this camera and we're unable to see them. While we might be on the same radio channel, as Phil pointed out, no one exactly knows where another worker is, and then you'll be driving along and there they are, coming right out of a blind spot in front of your vehicle. The cameras on the windshield block our view across the front of the van we're driving. They are dangerous to the persons inside the vehicle and anyone alongside or in front of our railroad crew or utility vans. While we're driving on yard roads between tracks where movement can happen at any time, this hazard can also include the public when we're out on the public streets and highways. Our BNSF crews and drivers also travel late at night across Minnesota, and we have members who have filed several complaints that their reaction time was delayed to brace themselves or to turn the wheel or not turn the wheel.
We have
Also, I'm aware that train crews across the state in BNSF locals 1137 in Fargo-Moorhead, 1175 in Duluth, and local 1177 in Wilmer want these so-called safety monitoring devices removed as soon as possible. I'd also like to point out that as Vice General Chairman, I also represent the collective bargaining agreement on the BNSF Railway, and I want to respectfully clarify that this is not a contractual issue at this time. I'm aware that the BNSF gave a brief informal presentation to the General Chairman in 2008. However, no action, amendment to the contract, was ever made regarding these devices. So clearly this is not a contractual issue, and it is a state of Minnesota safety issue. I think that we're headed down the path of a bad safety accident because of these cameras blocking the view of the drivers. And from anywhere from a minor collision to something far worse. So on behalf of our UTU membership, I ask for your support for the total prohibition of these devices from our railroad crew van vehicles. I can answer any questions you may have, and thank you for your time.
Mr. Brown, are these simultaneously taking front and inside the van? Are they taking pictures both ways at all times?
That's what? Correct.
There's no shutoffs on them? They don't? They're not quick stop and they take a picture?
My understanding is that they activate when there's a certain amount of shock to the camera system. That they activate and they capture 12 seconds before and 12 seconds after.
And is that permanently recorded, or is it on a rolling tape, or what's the deal on that?
I believe that it. I'm not 100% sure. I believe that it is sent to a database and kept.
Anybody answer that here? Well, he went off. Okay, well, let's move on. Oh, here. In other words, I'd like to understand the operation of the camera.
Well, Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you again. Philip Qualley for UTU. We don't know. We've had drivers tell us the design was that they would get feedback from the van company, who's a third-party contractor, the railroad company, and yet we're spending a great deal of time with these van drivers. And they're not getting the feedback. We don't know where the information goes, who owns the data, and we think that if this is a legitimate safety preventative technology, there ought to be some measurement going on and of the effectiveness. So to your question, Mr. Chairman, I apologize. We simply don't know. We're in an employment relationship. Our primary piece is concerns.
I don't want to spend a lot of time with safety. This, but I see one other question, Mr. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, testifiers. We're all interested in safety. The question that I just quickly ask is, do you know how this size of the camera and the installation is, whether it's similar or different from what our law enforcement agencies use for their cameras?
Yeah, 35.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman and committee member, I do not know. There are under 169.71, there are exemptions for emergency response vehicles to have those devices, as I understand the statute.
Thank you, Chairman. Just as a follow-up, the reason why I'm asking, because I believe that safety is important, and if the multitasking of our police officers have the same issue, then it's probably not as much safety as it is in driver education and driver awareness. And I'm a little concerned about, you're talking about the age and those the amount of hours that are worked as being probably more detrimental than the camera itself. And so I just raise that question. Thank you.
Okay, can we move on and be as brief as possible, sir?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Matt Labine. I'm from the UTU Local 650 on the UP property. We cover most of southwestern Minnesota, including Worthington, Mankato, St. James, all the way to Sioux City, up to the Twin Cities and Mason City, Iowa. Basically, we're talking about a blind spot. This latest cab company that has all these cameras in the van, they don't even use these. They're in a state of disrepair. They're just a piece of plastic on the windshield as far as we're concerned. And we've had some pretty bad close calls where one lady almost hit an 18-wheeler with the full crew in her van. We've had multiple close calls in the yards.
Did she get a good picture of it?
Not that I'm aware of, but okay. It took, you know, Phil already kind of went over this. It took a long time, 40 days to get this issue addressed just on this one driver. If this was actually being used in a positive manner, this driver would have probably been cut out of this a long time ago. I just don't want to see a fatality on the roads or an injury on the roads in the public roads. I mean, this could hit another car and hit the general public. I think that should pretty much cover it. Any questions?
Mary has any questions? If not, we will. There's some other folks that would like to testify.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman of the Committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I believe there are a few people that wanted to testify in opposition.
All these now. That's sweetie.
Good afternoon, Chairman and committee members. My name is Rusty Weiss, and I live in the St. Peter, Mankato area. And I work for a company called DriveCam that manufactures the device and delivers the services that are being referenced here. And my role with the company is with teenage drivers. We've deployed systems through a partnership with American Family and over 12,000 families, probably about 2,500-3,000 families in Minnesota. And we've had very positive results, independently verified and such. But my history was this, is I worked for the Mayo Clinic's Mayo Medical Transport a number of years ago, and we did a trial to test the effectiveness of safety systems, and the one we selected was DriveCam, and my involvement with that eventually led to an offer to go work for the company, and so I've been in employment with DriveCam now for the past 7 years or so, 7-8 years. I think some of the important things to consider right off the bat is the pictures in the packet you have show the camera from the passenger seat, and you should consider the how much of the camera blocks what view from the driver's seat, right? And so when it's properly installed, the bracket attaches to the glass on the windshield behind the rearview mirror. And if you install it to instructions, you look to see if the center of the lens is visible to the driver at the bottom edge of the rearview mirror. So rearview mirror here, this is how much is below the you know, that is, there is some, I can't deny, you know, there's probably an inch, maybe an inch and a half of space being blocked. And if you reach out to adjust your rearview mirror, when I do it, I tend to reach up. I'm 5'8" or so. I tend to reach up. And so the camera is typically, if I were 6'6", it would probably be different. But 6 foot tall, you know, so on. It's up here. And generally it blocks, as you can see in the pictures too, it's not terrible. It's information above and away from the roadway. And I think the rearview mirror has lasted in that space for as long as it has in virtually every vehicle that has a view out the back, because it has turned out to be kind of a time-proven safe place to put something out of the view of the driver that doesn't cost you distraction in the view of the driver. So that's why we're there. It's a good place to hide it. And it also gives feedback to the driver and lets them know with just a subtle blinking light if they do hit the brakes hard enough to lock your seatbelt, or if they turn sharply enough that if a coffee cup were on the dash, it would fly off, or if you were the passenger, you would want to hold on, right? So it's exception-based. It takes pretty hard braking. It takes pretty hard cornering. At that moment that it triggers, that little light blinks for about 10 seconds. It saves the previous 8 seconds of video inside the vehicle and out the front so that you can see what the driver saw, see what the driver's doing, and the 4 seconds after. So you get a 12-second clip, and that is variable, and I'm assuming that that's the standard format for that video. We don't store for a minute even. And in a year's worth of driving, a typical driver will maybe collect 5 total minutes of drive time in that note. So it's that exception that makes it work and why we've had such good driver acceptance in a lot of places. And then I thought of a review in my mind about projects we have going on where another person's employees are riding in a vehicle driven by somebody else. And the one project we have going on right now is the Centers for Disease Control our passengers in State Department vehicles in Haiti and other foreign places, and they're doing a pilot right now to protect their drivers, because the CDC employees were getting injured by I shouldn't rat out the State Department, but State Department employees were getting in crashes. And so the results for that aren't in yet, but their review of the systems that were available and recommendation from the NTSB, for example, is why they went that route. I think I've probably covered enough, but I'll be happy to answer questions. Oh, I'm supposed to show a video. Would you like to see a video of what one of these videos looks like real quick? Yeah? Okay. I have a couple of them. All right, so the lighting's not great. It's okay. So just real quick, that's the view out the front on the left-hand side, and you see what the goal is, to see what the driver sees so that you can judge their performance. What was traffic doing? Did they make a quick stop because they were paying attention and something unexpected happened? Were they not paying attention? And something very obvious for a very long time was visible, but they didn't react to it. Really makes that coaching moment poignant when you have accurate information. And on this side is the view with the driver on the right. The driver on the right, you can't see real well, but they have a cell phone in their lap. Driver looks down, truck in front comes to a stop, sees it late, and he has to hit the brakes hard enough, or hit the brakes to not hit it. Nice job not hitting it, but it was really preventable because of that late delay, and the late delay was because of the eyes down. So a very coachable moment. And another thing I thought of before, too, is this driver didn't get fired for that, right? This driver got coached. And you generally coach people to improve, you've got good evidence, and then you measure their performance in the future. So it didn't surprise me to hear that perhaps some of the drivers that had mishaps were still driving, because that's kind of the point of the program, is to remediate, improve the ones that are having trouble, and do that. And forward view only on this one. So this driver had a green light, right? And another car ran the red, and so the video protects the driver in this case. Other car ran the light, there's no question about it. And so we've certainly had a lot of support from companies that use it and drivers that are behind the wheel with it. For the truth helps a lot in situations like this. Questions?
You'd recommend Photocop then?
Sorry?
From what you're seeing, you'd recommend Photocop. That's another story. Mr. Sweeney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Sweeney. I'm with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul. We oppose this bill because, frankly, it would diminish the safety of railroad workers. This bill, despite what was said before, is not about safety. If you read the last sentence of the bill, it says, use of driver feedback and safety monitoring equipment in vehicles operated by a motor carrier of railroad employees is prohibited. This has nothing to do with location or size of the device. If it was the size of a pencil eraser and mounted on the roof of the vehicle, we still couldn't use it if this becomes law. So anybody else can use these devices in any other kind of vehicle, hauling whatever or whoever. The only place or application in the United States of America where this would be prohibited is transporting railroad workers in Minnesota. This is a proven safety device. I've never seen a bill that actually would ban us from using something that has been proven to improve safety. The United States National Transportation Safety Board supports use of these devices. In fact, it is recommended that they be installed in all trucks over 10,000 pounds and in all motor coaches. This follows studies that showed significant safety improvements from using these devices, which are also known as video event recorders, combined with a coaching system. I would encourage the committee to contract the Surface Transportation Board and inquire what they think of these devices and this proposed legislation. Several insurance companies support the use of them because they help with safety. American Family Insurance pays for the program and gives a discount for teenage drivers if the device is installed in the vehicle. I believe that members of the committee received an email yesterday from Dr. Michael Manser, director of the Human First program at the University of Minnesota. He has studied these devices. He took part in a study that was conducted by University of Iowa that used a group of 38 teenage drivers in Eagan, Minnesota, monitored the effectiveness of the camera program with them, and found a dramatic improvement in safety in a very short period of time, a 60% reduction in coachable events in just a 4 or 5 month period. So they do work. They are safe. These devices are used in municipal vehicles by many cities across the country, including Los Angeles, Kansas City, Houston, Orlando, New Orleans, and Atlanta, because of the safety benefits. Mayo Clinic has been using them in ambulances for several years. Greyhound Bus Lines is installing them in all of their buses. Waste Management is putting them in all of their trucks. Super Value uses them. These are safe. That's why they're being installed. As was mentioned earlier, the Center for Disease Control is using them. In the past 2 years that BNSF has been able to use these devices in Minnesota, events that trigger the recorders have dropped by 40%. That's comparable with what we've seen system-wide. We operate in a 28-state territory. More important, the coachable events in Minnesota, those that showed a driver error or driver conduct that required coaching, those dropped 80%. Reportable injuries to BNSF employees riding in crew vans have gone down to about... We've had a reduction of a third in injuries to employees riding in crew vans since we began using these devices on our system. As was mentioned, before we started using them, we rolled them out to the union general chairman. No exception was taken. In fact, in our 28 states, Minnesota is the only place where use of these devices has been controversial like this. So they help improve safety. Banning their use would be a step backwards in safety of railroad workers. Thank you.
Once again, I would say that you're an advertisement for photo recording of some sort at intersections and other places. But then Minnesota is a little behind, you know, like you said, from the rest of the states. Anyway, who's next?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Amber Backus on behalf of the Minnesota Trucking Association. The Trucking Association is also concerned about this bill and the precedent it sets. Operating safely is paramount to members of the Minnesota Trucking Association, and they are increasingly taking advantage of new technologies to help their drivers and fleets be safer. And many, in fact, are starting to use video cameras for in-cab driver monitoring to improve performance and reduce accidents. As Mr. Sweeney alluded to, there is a testimonial from Super Value in your packets talking about how that has reduced their accidents, and they've seen improvements there. So we would ask you to please reject public policy that discourages utilization of this technology that can make our roads safer. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have one other, Julie Selner.
That would be me. I'm Julie Selner. I work with First Transit. First Transit is an innovator in the transportation industry with a proven record of safety. And that's the reason why I'm here today to testify for the DriveCam. This is a proactive technology that allows us in developing and shaping driver behavior habits. One of the things that it does is it allows us to identify risky behaviors before it becomes an accident, before it becomes serious, change those behaviors for the better, and allow public safety. I cannot stress the word proactive enough. There are not very many tools in the transportation industry that allows us to be proactive in addressing risky behaviors, changing those behaviors into safe driving habits, and providing the tools that our drivers need to be successful. In summary, First Transit, we have used this technology for over the past 10 years. We've implemented it nationwide. And we use this tool throughout the United States. We believe that there is no better tool in the marketplace that helps to shape and develop safe driving habits, that allows us an ability to protect our drivers, our passengers, and the general public safety. Thank you.
Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Hillstrom, you want to conclude?
Thank you, members. This is narrowly crafted to deal with transportation at the rail yards and the railroad train crews. Members, you've seen little teeny cameras in the rearview mirror. That is not the cameras that we are talking about. We've passed around the photos of the larger big box cameras that ultimately have resulted in higher risk and near misses. And I ask that you vote yes.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment. A number of years ago, I remember I was, actually I did have a bill dealing with cell phone use in the car. And at that point, we were starting to move into the distracted driving. And we're kind of appalled that the new cars are having all these video things that are being put on your dashboard. And so while I'm trying to be open and I hear what you're saying about the safety, to put something in the middle of the window just drives me up a wall. I can't believe that you could make an exception for that. Just a comment.
Thank you. You want 1 minute, Mr. Quitt?
No, he's Father? Good, Mr.
He's
Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I actually want to say, Representative Mason, we're actually attempting to get rid of that exception. So we're trying to get rid of that camera in the middle of the windshield. So vote yes on my bill.
I think we will lay this bill over and for further consideration and possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the next item is Representative Beard is standing in for Representative Morgan on House File 646.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I remember signing on this bill because it seemed like a good idea, so give me just a moment to come up to speed on what we're dealing with here. And I believe, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 646, and it needs to go, I think, because of rulemaking, Matt, to government operations, so recommend its passage and be referred to government ops. And, Mr. Chairman, I believe I have a DE1 amendment, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Okay, where is that?
I'm looking at Mr. Scherer. He knows how to direct traffic here. Is there a DE1 amendment, Mr. Chair?
There is.
Would Mr. Chairman, I've moved the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the condition we'd like to present it, if I may.
Any questions about the amendment? We just put it on there, and all in favor of adding it to the bill to put the bill in the condition that the author would like, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is on the bill, 646.
Well, Mr. Chairman, can I briefly explain the bill and then hand this off to my expert witness?
Excuse me?
May I explain the bill and then I'll hand it off to my expert witness?
Oh, okay, fine.
Great, thank you. Members, this is an expansion of a bill that Representative Bruce Anderson, when he was a representative, introduced 2 years ago, and we heard and acted favorably on, that allows students to have a driver's permit while they're taking their classroom portion and also allows them to begin their behind-the-wheel training when they're in a certified course. At the moment, I believe you've come to understand that in Minnesota you have to do things progressively, take classroom, and then start behind the wheel and then get your permit. This kind of compresses things because I think there is a theory of education that while the young folks are actually engaged, they're learning hands-on in real time, and this makes more sense as a teaching philosophy. So, Mr. Chairman, what it does, though, in addition to allowing that, as we discussed extensively over the last 2 years, it also establishes a novice driver education improvement task force and have the Department of Public Safety work with our friends at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to bring Minnesota standards up to snuff with the new national standards for driver education. Mr. Chairman, perhaps it would be most beneficial to the committee if I introduce Mr. Joe Christensen and had him explain a little about the bill, and we could stand for some questions, if I may.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Joe Christensen, and I am the co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota Driver and Traffic Safety Education Association, shortly, quickly named MITSEA, and we have been working on trying to get Minnesota up to date on a couple things. The concurrent teaching is one of the items, and this is a permissive thing. It is not a requirement. And what it allows is to teach classroom and behind the wheel concurrently at the same time. If you think of teaching physics, like Representative Morgan does, you don't want to teach all of the classroom stuff one quarter and then go into a lab the next quarter and try to remember what you taught. You want to overlap lab and classroom. We would like to be able to do that in driver ed. Minnesota is the only state that does not allow that, and many states require it. The other issue here is the Novice Driver Education Improvement Task Force, and the purpose of creating that is so that we in Minnesota look at the national standards, which were promulgated 4 years ago now, and try to see if where we can come up to the national standards, or the alternative would be to say Minnesota doesn't need to meet that standard. But we've not had a look at that from the state point of view, and we as driver educators feel that we need to try to see what we can do to get us up to standards. The only item that those of us that have looked through the standards that we feel needs to be taken care of legislatively is the concurrent teaching. We believe that at least most of the other standards could be taken care of through rulemaking without having rulemaking or department decisions without making legislative changes.
Mr. Christensen, does this cause the time between the beginning of training and the ending to shorten so that the person taking the exam and so forth gets his license at a younger age?
No, it has nothing to do with either the age or the amount of time they need to be in classroom or behind the wheel.
Thank you. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on with respect to line 1.19 on page 1 of the delete all. Talking about 15 hours of classroom, but just give me a sense of what the total hours is in the program, if you would, so I get a sense of what percentage of the time we're talking about when we talk about 15 hours.
Good question, Representative Simonson. There is 30 hours required in the minimum number. Okay. So this is halfway through. Before the law was changed, I taught this concurrently, and at that time our students had the knowledge to pass the written test in 15 hours. It was a matter of, there are other things that you teach besides what's in the written test.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the surrogate presenter or Mr. Christensen? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beard, maybe the witness, is there a sunset date on the task force? Is it a task force? It seems as though its duties are kind of limited to a once-only review and a recommendation. It doesn't sound like there's any need to keep it going. I mean, I would, maybe you know differently.
My opinion is that the task force would end when the standards were looked at and either approved by the legislature or approved by rules or approved by the department.
And Mr. Chairman, it says specifically in the bill, and I'm not going to let me see the DE amendment. The subdivision expires once the House and Senate committees having jurisdiction determine, et cetera, et cetera. So once they've done their report, well, now I'm looking in the DE and it says August 31st, 2015, they'll submit it by then, and that once that happens, the committee has done its work and is done.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Comments? If not, Representative Beard, would you like to renew your motion that this bill be sent to passed and sent through government operations?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to renew that this bill as amended be recommended pass and re-referred to Committee on Government Operations.
All in favor of that amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Bill is sent to government operations.
Thank you, Mayor.
As amended, excuse me.
Yes.
Now you want to go to Representative Dean, are you already here? Okay. House File 1148. I'll move House File 1148 for consideration. And you have an amendment here, Representative Dean, H1148A1. You would like that attached at this juncture?
That is correct, Mr. Chair and members.
I will move that amendment, and all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Bill is amended. Now, we get to the bill as amended, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 1148 makes some changes to current subsection 8 on the special account related to the parking ramps that are the I-394 parking facilities, otherwise known as parking ramps A, B, and C in downtown Minneapolis. And it expands sort of what those funds can be expanded to be used for. The bill is very short, so I'm guessing I don't need to go through this for all of you. And I actually have Eric Rundin here from MnDOT who can answer any questions that you all might have, unless you have something you'd like to present as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may briefly add some comments, I'm Eric Rundin from MnDOT Government Affairs. As Representative Dean indicated, these are the three large parking ramps located on the edge of downtown Minneapolis. They were built when Highway 12 was upgraded to I-394, and they're part of the interstate system, so that's why they're owned by MnDOT. The City of Minneapolis operates the ramps through a private contract, and the current state law restricts the use of the ramp revenues, which limits the opportunities for investment. So this legislation allows expanded uses for the revenues in support of multimodal transportation options, and really since the Twin Stadium has opened, these ramps have been generating more revenue than is required to operate and maintain the ramps, and so that's kind of why we're here today. It's hoped that the proposal will generate additional opportunities for innovative solutions that support economic development and transportation options. The City of Minneapolis is supportive of this proposal, and we've also consulted with the Federal Highway Administration, and they're supportive of these changes as well. So it's our objective to manage the ramps in a way that maintains the intended multimodal and environmental benefits of the ramps while generating additional opportunities for innovative solutions to support economic development and transportation options. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions? Any members? Okay, if not, I'm going to lay 1148 as amended over the possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Thank you. Excuse me?
Thank you for doing that, Chair Ehart. I just wanted to thank you, Representative Dean. This is a really good bill, and think it's going to be helpful to our city of Minneapolis. So just wanted to thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Chair, perhaps just a question. We don't see anything about what kind of dollars it's generating. What is the size of something like this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, the ramps bring in about $13.5 million per year, which is about $1 million to $2 million over what is needed to operate the ramps. We do have a reserve of $7 million that the Federal Highway Administration requires in case there are major issues that come up. And we have, you know, planned major maintenance activities in the future. So, you know, we have those funds available. So it's really the money over and above that that's available for other improvements that will benefit the users of the ramps.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up,
Representative.
Mr. Rudin, the way that's expressed in terms in the bill, is that specific? So that, I mean, parking facilities, there wouldn't be any other definition of that or any other use outside the lanes themselves or the parking facilities? Is that how I can read that, or would there be other possible uses?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rumbach, there are other possible uses. For example, currently there are bicycle facilities that are actually part of the ramp. There are bike lockers and there are showers for people who commute by bicycle that use the ramps. Obviously pedestrians use the ramps to get to and from their vehicles. In the Twin Stadium Open, we put up some new wayfinding signage for pedestrians. Those obviously benefit the people who are driving to the ramps and then walking from their cars. So under this legislation, it would not be limited to automobile traffic. It would be more than that.
But if I could just add, Mr. Chair, it is for people that are users of the parking facility. So it's not as if these funds could be relocated to the riverfront in Minneapolis, for example.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Mr. Rudin, is there a parking fee if you are parking a bicycle?
This is Lisa Austin from MnDOT. So, Mr. Chair and Representative, the answer to that is yes, there is a fee for people parking bicycles.
Thank you.
Any other questions? We continue our journey then. We'll lay over and as amended, and thank you for presenting the bill.
Thank you.
Where do you want to go next? Sundin? Representative Sundin, would you like to present?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee. I've been contacted by the United Transportation Union, or the UTU, regarding important transportation policy legislation that will benefit the future of passenger rail service in Minnesota. In 2009, by legislative direction, MnDOT began an exhaustive study of the future of freight and passenger railroad transportation in Minnesota. The UTU has been a member of the advisory committee of the MnDOT Freight and Passenger Rail Forum and made an important contribution consulting to MnDOT on their technical findings. With the UTU, Minnesota benefits from decades of safe and dependable rail service for railroad workers all over the state of Minnesota. With me today to explain the bill is Mr. Philip Qualley, a 32-year conductor and state director of the UTU. We ask that the appropriate action be taken by the committee today for passages and for passage and possible inclusion in the transportation policy omnibus bill. Thank you.
You have testimony?
Yes, I do, Mr. Brandon. Chairman. Okay. I'll be brief. I have a prepared statement. Again, I am Philip Qualley with the United Transportation Union, a division of SMART. I want to thank you for allowing me to come before the committee again on what I hope is a little more pleasant item to bring to your attention. Again, in 2009, MnDOT undertook the State Freight and Passenger Rail Study, which has led to an outstanding nationally recognized platform for improved rail service in Minnesota. We believe that House File 1289 is the important next step for advancing Minnesota on the national rail map. And with House File 1289, we seek to assure that with any New START passenger rail service operating contracts, railroad workers are subject to our federal labor laws currently governing interstate common carriers. This has led to a structure of safety, security, and stability in our railroad workforce that has served the movement of commerce and general public safety for decades. Our railroad laws encompassed are the Railway Labor Act, Federal Employer Liability Act, the Federal Railroad Safety Act, and United States Railroad Retirement Act, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and others. Because railroad workers are able to have a voice in the workplace, we are equal partners in advancing safety in this industry. You know, a lot of people see the trains, but they don't see the people. And UTU are the men and women who are out running the trains across Minnesota and the nation. And we participate with the Federal Railroad Administration in the Rail Safety Act, the Switching Operation Fatality Analysis Group, the Collision and Awareness Working Group, Drug and Alcohol Federal Programs and Overview, as well as the Rail Safety Advisory Committee. And because we have the right to organize under the Railway Labor Act, we are able to have a voice in advanced safety in our industry. Currently, portions of House File 1289 language are referenced is contained in North Star Commuter Rail Service authorizing language from the 2006 legislative session, so there is somewhat of a precedent. And again, these laws are the longstanding underpinning of our industry for safety and security. While it has been presumed that these federal laws are explicit with any railroad passenger operation, new and proposed state authorized operating schemes necessitate the need to explicit subject to language with any New START authorization. At this time, Amtrak service holds these federal labor laws within operations. This legislation will give the state of Minnesota more flexibility if they do contract in passenger service to operate with a third party to operate any New START passenger service. Again, this legislation does not mandate Amtrak operation or set forth who may operate the New START passenger service. It sets a baseline to assure that MnDOT has the flexibility to contract for service with Amtrak as the operator or for any third-party operator contracting with MnDOT for authorization. So I look forward to answering any questions you may have, Mr. Chairman, but I would respectfully simply ask you to put yourself in our shoes as railroad workers. And while we have federal lands and state and local lands, railroads are privately owned interstate corridors of commerce. And we're the men and women who are out on the trains, and it's absolutely essential that we maintain a level of safety and security and stability in the workforce going forward. So while there is no proposed new passenger rail in the immediate future other than possibly the river route, which is before the legislature this year, we think that this helps the state set the baseline and will advance the state with any federal review of operations for Minnesota. By getting our ducks in a row, we will be helping Minnesota take an important next step for any passenger rail service in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Are there any questions for either the author or the witness? Representative Beard.
I just want to clarify, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Qualley, you know, we've discussed this for the last couple of years. I'm looking at lines 2.26 to 2.29. The fact of the matter is anybody engaged in interstate commerce on steel wheels and steel rails is subject to those things listed, Federal Employers Liability Act, the Railway Labor Act, OSHA, and the Railroad Retirement, and so on and so forth. Isn't that the case already? So if we're in interstate commerce and we got steel wheels and steel rails, we have to play by these rules, correct?
Mr. Pauley.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, not quite. It has always been presumed that that is the case. Mm-hmm. However, with recent authorizations for New START passenger, the federal government is encouraging flexibility of new operating scenarios mm-hmm. For a passenger rail inter or intrastate or heavy commuter. And one of the scenarios, there's basically three scenarios that could occur, as I understand it at this time, and I think the UTU Council will agree with me, and it's the third that I'll explain is what answers your question. You can have Amtrak run a service. You could have a private freight railroad operate your service. Those rights are already implied. However, if the state of Minnesota were to be the operator, or if the state of Minnesota contracts with a third-party operator and a New START operator, those questions may well come into play. We believe that, and so in the alternative, the question becomes, does if the state is operating or contracting to operate in a common carrier mode, unless this is set forth clearly, is the state then picking up a workers' comp scenario? Is the state picking up a potential pension liability? This is what is in play, and I think that in your handout you might see a piece from Railway Age from Mr. Frank Wilner, who I can supply information to the committee at a later date. It goes into much more detail on how the federal government is encouraging flexibility in operating plans. Sure. To your question, it's the third scenario, that if the state were to become the operator or contract as an operator, we believe it is best to have this explicitly stated in law so that there's a baseline for any contractual negotiations. Clear expectation of safety and stability in the workforce.
Any other questions? Representative Beard.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up, I'm going to try to get a little more precise.
Question is yes or no.
I'm trying to think of a yes or no question, Mr. Chair. For the good of the committee and for the clarification of this, I'm thinking your third scenario, the state's involved. Either they're going to run it, I'm thinking AFSCME. They're going to hire somebody else to run it, which could be a merit shop, or they're going to hire somebody else to run it, which could be UTU or BLE. Are you asking us in this legislation, yes or no, to prescribe who that's going to be, whether it's going to be an open shop, union shop, AFSCME, UTU? Are we picking and choosing and setting the commissioner's feet in cement by the passage of this bill if it should pass?
Mr. Pauley.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, thank you very much for the question. The answer is no.
Yay, we got a yes or no question, and I got a good answer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Hornstein.
So if I understand correctly, voting yes is expressing some concern about federal government overreach, meddling in our state's rights to choose some things, and a no vote means you're okay with the status quo. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, now you have confused me.
No, I'm just joking.
What we're saying is, again, is that whatever happens with the state contracting, our federal labor law rights are essentially preserved, and any contract entered into are subject to our railroad labor law rights at the federal level. We will have to assert our rights, but that any contracting, our federal labor law rights are intact.
Representative Beard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as much as I admire Mr. Qualley and want to look out for his best interests, I'm looking at Mr. Crom sitting behind me, who actually has to implement this and run it. Would it be fair to ask him to come down and just make a brief comment if he wish, or we could look at him and see if he's shaking his head? I can't turn around and see him.
I don't know. Where is he?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to ask him that question, if I may,
all right,
for the good of the committee. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Dana Crome. I'm the passenger rail office director for MnDOT. And to the bill, this is a MnDOT bill, but we do not have a position on the language itself. I mean, the federal law is the federal law. We would require that whoever would operate the service would be in compliance with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That tells me something. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Any other questions, comments, concerns? If not, I will lay over House File 1289 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Who's next? Huh? Oh, we got somebody else here. Where's Mr. Is he here? Okay. All right. Just give her the gavel. I'm passing the gavel to the vice chair of the committee, and I'm going to present from right here. We're going to look at House File 1017, which concerns legislative routes and turnback. And we have to explain this, Mr. Radin from the MnDOT sector.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a handout, and I don't see the pages.
I will move this for consideration. What? Yeah.
There's a handout to come around that will help explain the bill. Mr. Chair, again, I'm Eric Radin, MnDOT Government Affairs. The purpose of highway turnbacks is to improve trunk highways that no longer serve a trunk highway purpose and allow them to be turned back to a city or county in acceptable condition. Some of these are initiated at the request of MnDOT, while others are initiated at the request of the local road authority. Turnback funds, which is a special part of the 5% from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, may be used for a construction project to improve the route being turned back before it's turned over to the local government, or they may be used as a lump sum payment to the city or county to pay for future maintenance and repair. This program works to ensure that the right road is on the right system. And Section 1 of the bill allows MnDOT to transfer a portion of Trunk Highway 298 in Faribault to the Department of Corrections. This road functions as an access road for the Department of Corrections facility, and Department of Corrections has requested that they have the opportunity to manage that roadway. It's also, this turn back is supported by the State Academy for the Blind. As you can see on the map, they're also located along this roadway. Section 2 of the bill creates a new route number for the Stillwater, the new Stillwater Bridge, the St. Croix River Crossing. So it will be legislative route number 339. The highway will still be signed as Highway 36, but it's necessary to bring this portion of roadway onto the trunk highway system to create a new legislative route number in statute. For those of you who are new to the committee or new to the legislature, all trunk highways are explicitly laid out in state statute. Section 3 of the bill allows MnDOT to turn jurisdiction of Trunk Highway 235 over to Otter Tail County. This is between Parker's Prairie and Urbank, and the county supports this turnback. And then Section 4 of the bill allows MnDOT to turn jurisdiction of Legislative Route 256, which is signed as Trunk Highway 66, over to Blue Earth County. Again, the county is supportive of the turnback, and they are intending, in cooperation with the City of Mankato, to turn over a portion of the roadway to the city once the turnback happens. So these initiatives help to ensure that the right roads are under the jurisdiction of the proper road authority. And Mr. Chair, that's the bill. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions. And you do also have maps showing these turnbacks and the new route number for the St. Croix River crossing.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none?
I'm going to ask, Madam Chair, I know how road turnbacks happen and where they go to, but I'm not sure where railroads go to. Who do you turn them back to?
Railroads?
Mr.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, if a railroad is abandoned, there is a program, the rail bank program, where the state has the opportunity to purchase a rail corridor that's being abandoned and to preserve that corridor for a future transportation or utility purpose. And there are several of those around the state that have been preserved.
Okay.
Representative Earhart, anything?
That's all.
No. Okay, seeing no questions, is there anybody that would like to testify that's in the audience? Seeing none, Representative Earhart, would you like to move this to?
Yes. Well, you're going to lay this over.
Okay.
For possible inclusion.
In that case,
Madam Chair,
we will lay this over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. What was next? Hornstein? Representative Hornstein. On House File 1162.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I would move that House File 1162 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is a bipartisan bill that Representative Beard and I are co-authoring, and it simply just restates what was in the omnibus bill last year, which passed the House of Representatives, I think also bipartisanly. The reason it's back before us is that the powdered wigs and our colleagues with capes and powdered wigs over in the Senate didn't pass it, and okay. So... we need to repass it again and hope they'll come around. It's a simple enabling legislation to allow MnPass lanes on I-35E. This has been a very successful effort in the past and on 394 and 35W, and just also clarifies where the revenue goes have to MnDOT and the Met Council. So it's a successful program. People like it. It helps with congestion relief and helps fund our roads and transit system. So with that, members, I would ask for your support.
Any questions for Representative Hornstein?
Mr. Chair.
Rundgren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, really haven't followed MnPass too closely, but I know that there are people who are agreeing with MnPass, provided that it does allow us to build an additional lane in those instances. Does this bill do that? Makes that provision?
I could ask Mr. Peterson to clarify that, but there's a I know that on the 35E corridor, for example, there's a corridor planning process. Is that correct, Mr. Peterson, and so it's ultimately going to be up to the municipalities and MnDOT involved in that. But I will ask Mr. Peterson to tell me if I'm on the right track with that answer.
Mr. Peterson?
And if not, that's fine.
Mr. Chairman, Scott Peterson from MnDOT. Yeah, our MnPass plan and the map of the future MnPass system is in the handout that's being distributed right now. The MnPass lanes will only be added to corridors where we add capacity. And so, as Representative Hornstein referenced, our next project is 35E from downtown roughly to 694, and we'll be adding another lane in that corridor, and it will be a MnPass lane.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
And I want to thank, Mr. Chairman, I also want to thank Representative Beard for his work on this as well. He was out of the room when I presented, so...
No more questions, comments? Do you want to renew your motion to recommend a pass and to Transportation Finance?
Correct.
All right. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Passes to Transportation Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you. Does Beard say he will do this? We get it out of here. Representative Beard, are you prepared for House File 1095?
I can do this, Mr. Chair. Just a second, let me pull it up here.
Here it is.
Has he got the amendment? No? Okay. Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, where would you like this to go?
This is go to Public Safety.
Public Safety next?
Yes.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 1095, recommended pass, and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. This is, Mr. Chairman, one of the MnDOT's basically housekeeping bills, I understand. Actually, as I'm looking at the testifier sitting next to me, it looks like it might be the Department of Vehicle Services housekeeping bill. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I will be glad to introduce my star witness who can talk to us about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And this is our DVS policy bill. This bill makes several housekeeping changes to permits and vehicle registration sections to ensure that current business practices are consistent with our statutory provisions. There's one section that deals with permits. DVS issues a 30-day base permit generally for any out-of-state commercial vehicle that is not registered to operate in Minnesota. This bill removes a reference that it involves business types of circuses, carnivals, and other amusement transactions. The driveway transit in-transit license plate is issued for temporary purposes for transporting vehicles in transit from one destination to another within the state. In response to inquiries that we've had related to fraud and misuse, we are clarifying that this license plate is only valid in Minnesota. There have been law enforcement agencies that have contacted us where people are using that plate and traveling the country. And so we are specifying that it is only valid in Minnesota. The prorate unit in DVS issues a temporary permit to motor carriers that have a short-term need to have out-of-state registration, and we're clarifying that this is only for a 30-day period. And DVS is also proposing to repeal the one-way trip permit. After a recent review, we have not issued this type of permit for over 20 years. There's a section in the bill that deals with enhanced driver's licenses and identification cards. And as you may some of you may remember that we're here in the last legislative session, that legislation passed. Those are ID cards and licenses that are used for cross-border purposes. They're used just with land and sea across our borders. So you're talking about Canada, Mexico, and the Caribbean. And these can last for no longer than 8 years. These identity documents cost more than a regular driver's license or identification card because there's a RFID chip in the card so that as you're crossing the border, the Border Patrol can verify the validity of that document. We have one group of documents for seniors that are 65 or older that they can get a state ID card that would be at a reduced rate and also is valid for the person's lifetime. Unless they move, then they'd have to have the address changed. But we cannot offer that same process for an EID because of the costs involved to produce the card, and so this is making an exception for just the enhanced ID cards. The bill also offers or provides additional language because one of the requirements for the enhanced driver's license and, driver's license and ID card is that you have to be able to have the staff that are issuing them have FBI background checks. As a result, we need to have statutory authority that allows for that. Even though our staff do have criminal background checks, They aren't FBI background checks, which also require fingerprints. And the reason is that the FBI cannot do a background check unless there's a statute that applies to the law and the authority for them to issue the background check. We had it in rules, but Department of Homeland Security has told us that we have to have it in the statutes. In terms of commercial driver's licenses, we also need to have authority to do FBI background checks, and the reason is that the federal law, which authorizes us to be able to administer commercial driver's licenses, requires that they also, all of our staff that give tests, road tests or written tests, must have FBI background checks. And so that's what that provision is. And in that, this particular case, if we don't comply with that rule, the federal highway funds, 5% of those could be retracted from Minnesota's federal highway funds appropriation. We also have sections that are dealing with dealers, and we are trying to make sure that a limited use dealer, one that would work for a nonprofit such as the Courage Center, would have the same requirements as other dealers, so they'd have to have office space and have files that are available for us to do audits to ensure that they're complying with our regulations. We also have a change that we think would be helpful. Right now, if a dealer's license is refused, they have to wait a year to reapply. We would like to change that so that once they can come into compliance with our regulations, we can issue them the dealer's unit and they don't have to wait for the year. The other issue that we've talked about is the used vehicle parts dealer, and this would be adding permissible uses for those dealers so that we have uniform regulation of all dealers. And we also have a section that talks about the reporting of the sale of both late model and high value and older model vehicles that's inconsistent. And so what we're requiring is that we would reduce the time that a dealer notifies DVS of this fact from 30 days to 10 days. We're making just a few other clarifications. As I said, a lot of these issues are housekeeping, and one of them is that the current vehicle registration practice is to register all vehicles for a minimum period of 12 months. We would like to add consecutive months. It's not based on calendar years, it's based on the consecutive months. And finally, there's a statute that talks about certain veterans plates that have stacked letters. Those plates are no longer produced, and so we're asking that the legislation, that this legislation would delete those references in the statute. And so that's kind of the high points. I'm glad to answer any questions that anybody would have.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just first an observation. Thank you, Ms. McCormick, for the overview of the bill that I was trying to read, speed read, while I was sitting there beside you a moment ago. You mentioned the 5% holdback from our friends, the big bullies at the Federal Highway Department. I hope, Mr. Chairman, there's bipartisan resentment at the way they treat us. Over and over again, the 11 years I've been here, we get another great idea comes from Congress, whether it's a Republican Congress or Democrat Congress, doesn't seem to make any difference, that we're going to conform or else they're going to hold back money. And I got to tell you, that just really sticks in my craw. I'm not shooting at the messenger, Ms. McCormick. We love you dearly, but I just got to let you know that that's really starting to irritate this member. The other comment or question actually I have is that there's a portion of the bill about the about shortening the amount of time that the scrap dealers have to hold before they dismantle a vehicle. You remember we had a little discussion here last year, 2 years ago, I think the Ramsey County attorney was looking for some help. Does this relate to that, or is this a step in the right direction of helping protect people with older value cars?
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, I'd say it's both, but yes, it was an issue that was discussed in relation to the Metro Metals issue.
Are there other questions for Representative Metza or Ms. McCormick? I think we should send this to public safety then. But I was going to ask the question here. I see there's several references to background checks authorized. And with your experience now, I suppose you'll be doing the background checks for the new gun legislation. No, you won't. Okay. Would you like to renew your motion, Representative Beard, I think?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to do that, to recommend House File 1095 to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety.
All in favor, please say an aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Well, for the record, Mr. Chair, I think this was the easiest bill I testified on so far.
Wait till you get to public safety.
Yeah. Well, you're on your way to public safety now. You got anybody else?
Thank you.
Okay. We have a meeting tomorrow, and then tomorrow night we'll try and finish up. So I don't know what time that is, 6:30 or 15 minutes after session. So outside of that, we speeded through and somebody hit out and we didn't quite get done, but we will do that tomorrow, and thank you all, and we'll see you tomorrow. Adjourned.